in the first layer of football. Then everyone in the world will fix their eyes on you, and everyone in the world will know you. Football is the key to fame. Football is the key to popularity. Fame and popularity will bring power and wealth. This is what subconsciously draws politicians to football.
The 45-year-old is the third richest person in the UK with an estimated fortune of over £10 billion. He bought Chelsea Football Club in 2003 and has the ear of the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who got extremely rich after the collapse of the Soviet Union and about the power struggles in modern Russia.
The name of many politicians in the world are so tightly intertwined with football that people in the world can hardly remember their political designation. For example, not many people remember Roman Abramovich, the owner of the Chelsea Club, was once a member of the Russian parliament, the Duma, or was a governor of a district in Russia. Many people in the world know Silvio Berlusconi, not a powerful former Italian prime minister, but as the owner of AC Milan club. Many people don't care the current owner of the Manchester City club is the vice president of the cabinet of minister of the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and this is not the entire story. Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia, played football in friendly and local matches in front of thousands of his supporters and those who voted for him.
Sadi is sort of the black sheep of the Gaddafi family. He tried to enter professional football or soccer in Italy. He played one game for Perugia, but then failed a drug test.
Sadi, Gaddafi's third son, left no stone unturned so he could play in Calcio. And the legendary Fidel Castro loved to spend time with Maradona, a world-class legend of football. Many politicians are directly engaged in the game of football. The story doesn't end here. Political parties and groups love to use the popularity of great football players to achieve power. For example, Kaká Khaled, AC Milan's robust defense, was elected as the mayor of Tbilisi. Before that, George Weah, the legendary striker of Milan, became the president of Liberia. Brazil's Romário became a member of parliament in his country. Before that, Hakan Şükür, the renowned Turkish forward, was voted to become a member of parliament. In 2008, when Roman Pavlyuchenko was scoring a goal against Edwin van der Sar like this, he had been voted as a member of the Duma in Russia. Sometimes it's the football players themselves who use people to guarantee that their people's political goals will be fulfilled. For example, Dr. Socrates, with his memorable goals against Russia or Italy, he was a genius who would sometimes wear headbands with political slogans on them. He would also wear shirts with political slogans and would fight the military dictatorship in Brazil like a revolutionary. Or Lillian Thuram, who made interviews in support of immigrants and black people and those who live in shanty towns in France. He had vitriolic words for then French president.
When you're the president of the Republic of France, you can make speeches like Mr. Sarkozy did in Dakar, for example, when he explained that black people had never made a mark on history. It was a racist speech.
Or Didier Drogba, who used his popularity to help stop the civil war in the Ivory Coast. Football and politics are twins. When no politician could ignore a weapon named football, and when insignificant clubs and less famous players can have remarkable political roles and influence, it's only natural that the World Cup turns into a major opportunity for political campaigns. Millions of people are glued to the games for a month. The headlines of all media are about this big event. All cameras in the world are directed towards the World Cup. It's the best opportunity to be seen, to be known, to become popular, and to gain power and influence. That's why most of the great politicians, one way or another, pretend that they're involved with the World Cup. That's why politicians try to direct the World Cup.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The game of the politicians for the World Cup starts from the time of selecting the host. They meet FIFA officials. They discuss with other heads of states. They deliver speeches and advertise. They spend their money, fame, and credit. Even in some cases, they might spend illegal money to be chosen as the host. Being chosen as a host means economic boosts, increase in popularity, and to a great deal, guaranteeing the political future. It's natural that people in a country are satisfied with the politicians who take the most important event to their country. But what if they're not the host?
Landon, what do we got? Hope you guys caught that. That doesn't happen very often. Okay, and what do we got here? That's good. Thanks, guys.
Well, in that case, they meet the players and the national team coach as a first stage. Almost all presidents and prime ministers take a sneak peek at the national team preparations before they go for the competitions. They take as many pictures as they can and record videos with famous players and announce their support for the representatives of their country to the world. And now, they have to show themselves in the World Cup. They enter the stadium and sit right next to each other in the VIP stands and show themselves so worried or happy so everyone knows that there is nothing more important for them than their national team. If they can't take part in person, they record a video message.
Man, I just wanted to call and say you guys did us proud.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys captured the hearts and imaginations of the whole country. It's unbelievable.
Well, we heard you were watching, and we know how big a supporter you are, so hopefully we made you proud. It was our honor, as it always is, to represent our country.
All right, appreciate you guys. Safe travels back.
Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Sometimes they even make controversial interviews about the incidents during the World Cup. For example, after Suarez was dismissed and Uruguay was defeated by Colombia, then-President Jose Mujica took part in the ceremony to commemorate the Uruguayan football star and in an interview branded FIFA officials as a bunch of sons of who defeated his country's team on purpose. It's true, an all-out political show takes place on the sidelines of the World Cup. That's why politicians get extremely happy over their team's ascent to the World Cup. The The World Cup gives them plenty of opportunities so they can promote their status or stabilize it, or at least it gives them an opportunity to show themselves to the world.
And the break is on Amiri. Osmoun's through on goal here. He can put it round ahead. It's Osmoun! Suspended save. Into Hatfash.
The first achievement is getting closer to the citizens. Ordinary people are crazy about football. They love their national team. Victory, pride, and their flag is more important than anything else for them. When the president of a country watches people's favorite team just like them, it can mean that he's part of the people. He has the same interests and obsessions, and he will do anything so their favorite team, namely the favorite team of his fellow citizens, will win. This public belief is a major point in the minds of voters in the next elections and in the mind of the people in other countries who consider it as a symbol of a nation. Besides all of this, participation of a country in the World Cup and its success during the games will change everything in that country. Public joy and spirit, unity among the people, and even satisfaction with the standard of living. Politicians love the World Cup. They use this opportunity to achieve their goals, and this is one of the reasons of the theory that the World Cup is a political phenomenon. Yes, it's one of the reasons.
It's Jerdan Shaqiri now for Switzerland. Can he win it? Shaqiri scores! What a turnaround from Switzerland! One goal down at the break. They have now scored twice in this second half.
The other reason is politics has always imposed itself on the World Cup throughout history. The competitions have always been a symbolic scene for conflicting political forces. It's a rich political history. The 1934 World Cup was held in Italy. Mussolini, the fascist leader of Italy at the time, would go to the stadium, becoming the champion was so important for Mussolini that he did whatever it took to achieve that. He even invited the referee who would officiate the Italy-Austria match to a private party on the eve of the game. The flamboyant closing ceremony of that edition of the World Cup was held in a completely nationalistic atmosphere. The political tinge was obvious in the next World Cup as well. When the national anthem of Italy was being played, the Italian players hailed like fascists as a military unit. On the other hand, the German team was a combination of German and Austrian players, 7 German players and 4 Austrian players, because the same year, Hitler had managed to annex Austria to German territory. That year, Italy became the champion for a second time. Mussolini achieved everything he wanted from football, nationalistic passion, joy, pride, public excitement, and unity. Later on, in the 1954 World Cup, Bern was a realm of muscle flexing for Germans. Only 9 years after a war that ruined the country, the Germans showcased their indefatigable and fighting spirit. In the strangest final match in history, they defeated Hungary in a dreamlike comeback and revived their national pride that had been trampled upon. Now, the defeated Germany had something to take pride in, a symbol of the uprising of a country that had lost everything it had. In the following World Cups, football turned into a symbol of rivalry between the East and West. The Eastern Bloc countries try to flaunt the orderly structure and teamwork in their societies within their teams as well. For them, football was a battle. It was an arena to prove that their philosophical and political beliefs were correct. In the 1958 World Cup, the Soviet Union defeated Britain, and North Korea became a phenomenon in 1966 and defeated powerful Italy
1-0. Later on, in a playoff match in 1974, the Soviet Union had to play against Chile. The political officials of the Communist Party decided not to play in Chile as a protest. Pinochet, the Western-backed dictator, had just orchestrated a coup, and the Santiago Stadium had turned into the biggest political prison in the world. FIFA announced the result 3-0 in favor of Chile. As ordered by General Pinochet, the Chilean players were in the field and were attacking the Soviets' empty goal. Chile took part in the 1974 World Cup. The confrontation between the East and West reached its climax when the two swaths of the post-war Germany, namely the East and the West, played against each other. Afterwards, politicians came up with the idea of changing the results. There are strange but unconfirmed reports about match fixing in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. General Jorge Videla, the Argentine dictator back then, and Morales Peros, the Peruvian president, they say the Argentine government forcibly disappeared some of the Peruvian dissidents, exactly the way it would deal with its own dissidents. In return, Peru received 6 goals in a suspicious match and paved the path for Argentina to become champion. The dictator back then needed it to calm the public. Four years later, in the 1982 World Cup, fixing the outcome by political authorities did not need any conspiracy. When Kuwait received the 4th goal from France, a Kuwaiti official got into the field and kicked a fuss and threatened that he'd get his team off the field. The fuss yielded a result. The referee disallowed the goal, and the raging politician went back to the stands.
The World Cup is beloved across our planet because it offers a chance for people from around the world to be judged not by the place they grew up, the color of their skin, or the way they choose to worship, but by their spirit, skill, and strength.
And finally, one of the most politically charged games in the history of the World Cup, the match between Iran and the U.S.
As we cheer today's game between American and Iranian athletes, I hope it can be another step toward ending the estrangement between our nations.
Let's not forget that the World Cup is not just a sports event. It's part of a political process for politicians to gain power and popularity. Let's not forget that only with a little attention, we could see that the World Cup, with all of the issues that surround it, is a tool in the hands of different governments to push their goals forward. Let's not forget that every minor incident in the World Cup might affect the political fate of millions of people. And the exciting and attractive games of the World Cup can be more than a simple football match. For example, it might be a political battlefield for two countries or two political schools. Let's remember that political powers affect the World Cup, and the World Cup affects political powers. This time, we can view it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host for today's episode. And here with me, I have Sister Zainab. Welcome to your studio, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to you and all dear listeners. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and it's always a pleasure to be here with you, because I'm pretty much sure that we're going to have such a beautiful discussion about everything that is related to Muslim ladies. Just to start the discussion, I would add it this way, that women have come a long way since they started joining the workforce in large numbers in the late 19th century. At first, how the story began was that they started to be workers and laborers because of that industrial revolution and whatsoever. And the lack of laborers that they had, women started to come and lend helping hand to all the men out there. So at the first place, it did not have such a prestige for a woman. It was just for the lack of, insurance, money, whatever, things like that. It was not a matter of prestige or anything that would add to your independence. But little by little, as we went further, the story changed, and women started to become independent creatures for themselves. Like, they started to be doctors, they started to have great responsibilities in society, in policy, whatever. Now you can see that women have got a great role in their societies and wherever they are. So now the question is that, can women go for all the jobs they love?
They can, provided the jobs they love do not interfere with their modesty, chastity, with their Islamic dress code, overall with their inward and outward modesty. The question which is over here, that can they go for all the jobs that men go for?
Yeah.
It's more important.
Considering their natures.
Yeah. Because of their unique physical capabilities or the capacities they have, women are excluded from some of the jobs just because that does not endanger their health.
Yeah, so I guess it's safer to say that nature has restricted them from going for all the jobs that they might wish to go for.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a woman cannot be a miner.
Exactly, but see...
It would be a drudgery for her.
Yeah, in fact, there's one of the countries that strictly has strict laws for women miners, and that's China.
Yeah.
And China prevents women from mining. In fact, China Mining and Technology University has male-only entrance exams policy, because according to the labor laws of China, mining is considered to be unsuitable for women.
Yeah, for her health, of course.
Yeah, so it's not just for health. There are so many things. Like, there are some things some governments have really realized that this does not suit a woman.
Yeah.
So realizing her anatomy, realizing her nature, realizing her being a soft creature. So there are some countries in the world that have really realized that women should be abandoned from this kind of
some
labor.
Some special difficult jobs.
Yeah, and I agree with some of them. I won't say all of them, all of the countries where they actually restrict a woman from doing particular kinds of jobs. So there are some emotional things. Women is restricted from a job. And there are some physical things. So coming back to physical capacities. A woman is restricted from many of the jobs, and I think it's an honor to her if she's restricted over here, because yeah. there is this kind of slogan, gender equality or gender justice, which is even as per the Supreme Leader, which is a slogan to use women as a another,
for their benefit, of course.
For their benefit.
It's not for the benefit of women. It's for the benefit of societies and their policies.
Yeah. So their slogans are very different, but there are some countries seriously who have, realizing the physical capability of a woman, they restrict her from certain jobs. Like, for example, I'll give an example of Argentina. Women are not legally allowed to polish glasses.
To clean the glasses.
Yeah. And exactly, just because they have a softer physical anatomy. They get hurt easily. In fact, you may see, I was just going through some of the videos on social media where I saw like a woman just cutting the potatoes and her finger getting, injured. And at the same time, man doing the same thing. And when a woman does that, she cries a lot. And even if a man gets hurt, he does not cry himself. The woman starts crying.
yeah, because of her nature again.
Yeah, it was a funny video, but that has some reality in it. Yeah, woman has that kind of nature. So if she gets hurt physically, she can't bear the pain so easily and as the men can.
So this was just the beginning of the topic. We just opened up this box of worms, and then we'd go for a break. After that, we'll catch up the rest of the story. Muslim ladies, this is your own program, and Sister Zainab and I are talking about jobs, the nature of women, and can they go for all different sorts of jobs, like, I don't know, mining, or I also have seen a documentary on women, on different jobs that women got, and then one of them was very strange to me. This woman was a truck driver. Considering the nature of a woman, that seems to be, strange, sort of nothing that you have seen always in front of you. So, and then I thought, okay, maybe she is in need of that job, right? But again, what would happen to her nature? If we as society did not consider her nature, what is going to happen to these women? And right now there are going to be a large number, not just one, two, or three. There are these women that are actually wishing to go for strange jobs, which is not going to be good for their health. And at the same time, it's going to be very difficult for them. So now I would love to know, is there any other country that would restrict women from special jobs for the benefit of women in the name of women?
Like we were talking about, depending on their physical capabilities, some countries have really realized that women not to be doing certain kinds of jobs. We have Belarusian women can't drive buses that has more than 14 passengers.
Oh,
we do have women as bus drivers in India too, but this country, Belarusian, does not allow women to drive a bus that has more than 14 passengers. And I realized this, the reason behind this, when my sister got a car and she started, and my mother said, like, can you tell her just to drop us here, drop us there? And then I asked her, why don't you drop them here and there? She said, like, I can drop them here and there just once a day or twice a day, not all the time. I can't be driver all the time, because whenever all the people who are staying in my car, I feel like all the pressure is on my arms. Then I had to talk to my mother again, and I told her, you realize.
So it's a mental pressure.
Yeah, I told her it's not just physical pressure on her, it's a mental pressure. So it's like, do not go out whenever it's unnecessary. So now it was just a family thing, In family, you have comfortable car, you have comfortable things. But when you are, as a woman, or a bus driver, just imagine. why women go for jobs, actually, in general jobs. Why do they go for jobs?
Well, general jobs, we could say that, okay, she wants to be independent and she wants to build an empire of her own.
Yeah, and there are some many other reasons. We can actually analyze them in future sessions, I guess.
So as you said, there are many countries that have restriction for the choice of job for women. And that was interesting because I didn't think that there is such a thing, such a restriction in countries for women to go for special jobs.
Exactly. There are some countries who have realized those, you know, the honor of women in terms of her physical health. I won't say they definitely realized her dignity and status like Islam does. Islam considers her as a human being. So we are not actually touching on Islam yet. But there are some countries just looking at her physical anatomy, they are restricting her from certain jobs. We said like in Argentina, they don't allow her to go for glass polishing. We said in China, they don't allow her to go for mining. Yeah, and there's another country, Guinea, that prevents women from working with certain types of hammers. So there are certain kinds of hammers which are really heavy, which are not... But look at some countries which are actually, or some governments which are encouraging women to go for weightlifting.
Mm-hmm.
And look at these countries who are realizing the anatomy of women and telling her you're not legally allowed to work mm-hmm. with these kinds of tools, like some kinds of special hammers.
Now, this is a very interesting topic to think about. I would love all you women out there to think about it, really, why certain jobs are very difficult, yet some special women, I would say special women, are attracted to those sort of jobs. There are, of course, many reasons, and in following sessions, we might go for them. But right now, as we're finishing today's episode, let's go for a break. And then after that, we would have a wrapping up of whatever we have said up until now.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Yeah, women are delicate creatures and they must go for jobs according to their nature. This is, I guess, the main factor that we should consider whenever we are going to, I don't know, nurture our girls or maybe get attracted to a certain job or go for a certain job and these sort of things. So we were talking about the countries that have got some restriction laws for women to go for special jobs.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with them in certain cases, but definitely maybe not all. But yeah, realizing the physical anatomy of a woman, realizing the physical capabilities of a woman and not allowing her to do some particular jobs, I think I do agree to a greater deal with them. Yeah, sometimes some women love to be just because they are adventurous. But in general, because we are talking in general about women, we are not, whatever we have been talking about, we are talking in general. Like, not all women are like that. Their body features, their physical capabilities do not allow them to be like that. So, yeah, Russia does not have truckers in women. And there are 400 plus jobs in Russia that women are restricted from doing. 400 plus jobs. Like,
wow.
But Russia is actually having a deeper look into the women and anatomy, yeah. Honor. Like China said, it's not in the honor of a woman to be a minor.
Exactly.
Okay. And even in India, we have like, you know, if you're just going through, you have small girls who clean your car glass and you just pay them for this. In a similar way, France bars women from labor activities that involve carrying loads heavier than 55 pounds.
Yeah.
So we have seen
this one is also good.
Yeah. We have seen some of the countries, like, you know, they have something in common. Do not give heavy loads to women.
Exactly.
And this, again, reminds me of, you know, Imam Ali al-Islam's letter number 31 says in Nahjul Balagha that women are like flowers. They're not servants.
Wow, such a deep and beautiful thing. Now I'm just thinking about what you said, and it's very nice. Exactly, that's the way I imagine a woman. She's a delicate thing, just like a flower, and you cannot take this flower into the desert and then expect her to be just a beautiful, flourishing flower. So, yeah, women must take care of themselves, I guess, at the very first step by themselves. And then a society has to go for laws protecting women from getting heavy loads. And these heavy loads, you can take it as ironically, because sometimes you don't give them heavy loads as in you give them, I don't know, wood or anything else to carry, but it's a mental load that you're giving them, which is going to be a great pressure for a woman to take in. So thank you, sister. And thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another episode, I just bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Rabbana
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers, sisters and dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We got to the point where Imam Sajjad عليه السلام in supplication number 8 in As-Sahif Sajjadiyya, he says, Oh Allah, I seek refuge in you from su'ul wilayati liman tahta aydina. Mistreating, guarding badly those who are in our care. We were looking at the list of the people who are under our care in the previous episodes. So we said we have parents, we have siblings, we have spouses. At a point of our time, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make me in charge of my own kids, be it as a father or as a mother. Nevertheless, I will be in charge of these poor children. And it is a great responsibility that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives to the parents. Now, for those who don't want to have kids, obviously, they are relieved of this duty. But for those who do, the duty becomes greater. So how do we treat those under our care when it comes to kids? Do we give them their needs? Do we deprive them of their needs? Or do we let nature take its course when it comes to kids? Because some people and some parents, they just let nature take its course. Whatever happens, happens. They have no plan whatsoever when it comes to their children and how they should take care of them. Before we dive into this topic, let us take a short break and then we will come back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So we're saying that when it comes to kids, sometimes we can mistreat our kids. And this is a very long, lengthy topic, because when it comes to children and upbringing children, it's a whole subject by itself. But we just stay with the headlines here. As a parent, I can mistreat my children, first, physically, either by hitting them, by harming them. That is absolutely haram. No parent has a right to lay a hand on their kids, no matter what. Even in jurisprudence, we say that when a parent hits his children, then he needs to compensate. He needs to pay kuffara for it. I had a child, one of my students, he was only 11, 13, and when we started speaking about fiqh, he asked me that question. He said, does a father has a right to hit his kids? And I said, no. No father has a right. And actually, if he does, then he needs to pay in gold. That's the penalty. Paying in gold. And a lot of it. And some parents, when they stand in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they have to answer to that. Because all this hitting, it doesn't go to waste. It's all recorded. Allah does not take it lightly when a person or a parent hits his children. And sometimes as parents, because we lack the knowledge, we lack the method to raise our children, so our response is hitting. And this is not a good way of upbringing and raising our children, through hitting. So we cannot cause them any harm. So sometimes we mistreat our kids who are under our care by hitting them. The Imam says, oh Allah, I seek refuge in you from su'ul mu'amala. That's really bad, that I can't do this. I have to become very sensitive or loving and caring towards my kids, not vice versa. So su'ul wulaya, right? Because Allah has given you authority, has given you guardianship, has given you whatever you want to call it. You're in charge, responsibility. Don't misuse that. So wulaya, that's what it means. You are mistreating, misusing the position that Allah has given you when it comes to your kids. So physical harm is absolutely forbidden in every shape and form. Let's take a short break and then we will continue.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program, Bridge. We were saying that we have a duty of care towards our children. We have no right to abuse them physically. Sometimes parents who don't abuse their kids physically, they might abuse them verbally. And this is a very, very common thing between people, and obviously depends on the geographical location that could either intensify or it could intensify. So it depends. So for example, in Asian countries or this region of, you know, the Asian countries, mistreating your child verbally is a very common thing. In the West, maybe they're a bit sensitive about it. But nevertheless, it happens with a lot of parents, especially when it comes to name-calling, which seems to be very, you know, easy on the tongue of a lot of parents by naming their kids names, calling them animal names, whether it is the animal, just saying to the person, you are an animal, calling them dogs or pigs or donkeys or what have you. Allah says it's haram in the Quran. He says, وَلَا تَنَابَزُ بِالْأَلْقَابِ. Do not call one another names or nicknames. It's haram. So I don't have no right to call my children these kind of names. In fact, even psychology today tell us that these leave prints on the soul of the child, on the mind of the child, when you call them names. And as they grow older, they grow weak, feeble. Their self-esteem is low. Their mentality is low. Why? Because they've been subjected to such treatment and to such words. In fact, we should be doing the opposite. Encouragement, nice words, gentle words. That's how we bring leaders to this world. Because the more we say bad words to our children, the more hatred we try to plant in their hearts, the more jealousy we plant in their heart, the more evil we plant in their hearts. So the Imam says, oh Allah, su'ul wulaya, mistreating my guardianship, I seek refuge in that. We will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al Musavi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene. Because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. Thank you. the Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on Earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim, or the hands of the victim, back to the first public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people. For any small thing, you could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. Though many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery, the oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands and unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects,